Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast. Delighted to introduce our special guest for this session, Townsend Feehan, who is CEO for IAB Europe. Hello, Townsend.
Hi. Hi, Rachel.
Welcome. All the way from Brussels. This is exciting.
Fun to be with you guys.
Amazing. And, of course, my fabulous colleague, Lindsay Rowntree, over in Walthamstow. How are you, Lindsay?
Hi there. I'm good. How are you?
Yep. All good.
Wonderful.
So let's dive into our news stories for the week. Our first news story for the week is an announcement that was delivered by the European Court of Justice earlier on this week, focusing on what is known as the EU-US Privacy Shield, or otherwise understood as a privacy agreement. So this was an agreement that enabled entities to transfer data internationally from European constituencies to the US and receive assurances under this agreement that the data subjects' rights would be protected as part of that. Now, a complaint was brought forward by an Austrian lawyer and data protection activist named Mark Schrims, who was citing the fact that Facebook in the US is obliged to pass on data and information to US surveillance agencies such as the FBI and CIA. And he was using that as an example to say that the privacy shield no longer protects data subjects in the EU from being subject to sharing that information onwards to surveillance agencies. And so therefore it should be effectively nullified for these purposes. So what this means is that the ECJ have now ruled that the surveillance laws in the US, because they're too far reaching, circumvent the privacy shield, and therefore the responsibility is transferred back to the data, the data owners. So the data owners will now retain responsibility for what happens to that data once it's passed on. The reason that I wanted to raise this as an interesting news story, and why I'm particularly interested in your perspective on this, Townsend, is because it sort of suggests to me that there's going to be quite an implication for a number of European companies, and particularly those in the advertising and marketing industry who have got responsibility for customers' data subjects' rights and protecting user data and adhering to GDPR rules and laws. So I'm really interested in hearing your perspective on this. I'm also interested in a general opinion on whether you think this will have an impact on the way in which companies seek to share data, particularly within the environment of social media platforms. So is this going to give perhaps, buyers of media in those social media environments something to think about? Are we going to see brands and marketers being a little more wary of where their customer data ends up and how it gets used? So, yeah, over to you, Townsend. Tell me what your perspective is of this news.
Okay, well, I think you're right that there's some important implications. Interestingly, the implications or the consequences aren't necessarily the ones that have caught the headlines. So you're right that the news cycle has been around Privacy Shield being annulled. So the commission's finding that the U.S. is adequate or can provide an adequate data protection to people sitting in the EU, that decision has been annulled, and it's actually not so surprising. It's a little bit of the safe harbor ruling a few years ago. It's for the same reasons, essentially, because it is not clear that the potentially quite intrusive U.S. government surveillance powers, which are dictated by the executive and can be changed rather easily and quickly by the executive, so which undermines predictability. It's not clear that that landscape enables the adequacy finding to hold up in all circumstances. So what's the thing that is been a little bit out of the headlines and is potentially more interesting is that the ruling draws out The predicament companies are facing who are trying to rely on these special contractual clauses. So you don't have, there's no adequacy anymore. My understanding is that the impact is immediate. So there's just no privacy shield to rely on. You had 5,000 or 6,000 companies listed in the annex to that decision that you know now aren't able to avail themselves of it. So any company sitting in the EU that was working with one of those 5,000 or 6,000 companies can't rely on the privacy shield anymore. EU users don't have sufficient remedies in case of an invasion of their privacy by U.S. government agency. And those agencies' powers are just too far reaching. The predicament companies find themselves in now, the court has essentially said, the privacy shield doesn't work. You now have these special contractual clauses, which are approved by the commission or by a DPA. That's what you need to rely on. And as you say, Rachel, it's up to the data controller to make the assessment on a case-by-case basis of whether he can guarantee that an adequate level of protection of his users' personal data can be guaranteed. So he can either rely on his existing contractual clauses and assume, try to make the case that users, he can protect his users' data despite this these challenges in the U.S. environment. He could take his existing clauses and try to build in some extra language somewhere that would provide more protection for his personal data of his users. The court talks about adding in extra language, or he could just decide, there's nothing I can do about the NSA and the FBI, and so I just have to stop making these data transfers to processors that are sitting in the U.S. So that's a really hard hard position for any company to be in. It's basically put a lot of data controllers in a virtually impossible position. It's also put regulators in a very difficult position. The regulators, individual DPAs, another aspect of the decision was to impose on DPAs an obligation to act and to protect the interests of citizens, sitting in their markets. So DPAs then could be put in the position of having to make these judgments, which, apparently even the European Commission hasn't been able to make in an adequate way. So companies are on their own with existing clauses that are a contract between two private companies. You guys have probably read this in some of the coverage. Special clauses are just a contract between the controller sitting in Europe and the processor sitting in the U.S. They can't possibly have any influence on U.S. government surveillance. So it's like a tool that, from the get-go is probably not going to solve the problem. Companies will have the option of making the case that, my company is perhaps small. I perhaps don't process that. I'm not transferring that much personal data. I've never been the object of an information request from a U.S. Intelligence agency, so I'm probably safe. It's not very comfortable. So it could be a paper chase in the best scenario for small companies. For the bigger companies, the big platforms who demonstrably are not infrequently the object of that kind of information request, it's hard to see what kind of guarantees they could build into special clauses. So it's like a decision that it's unclear what those bigger companies are going to do or what choices they have. They can opt to put more data, keep more data, physically in Europe, it's actually not completely clear that data sitting in Europe would be beyond the reach of those intelligence agencies. So it's a super uncomfortable outcome in a way, but that is not, not completely unexpected. It's a hard ruling and hard to know what especially the bigger companies and social media platforms that you mentioned can do.
So this is the thing. I mean, you know, thank you. That was really helpful, you know, much more detailed synopsis of the ins and outs than I was able to provide. But this is the thing, I suppose, that the first two questions that leads me to are, what therefore will this result in companies not sharing information to US data processors because they're concerned of the risks? And actually, if what you say turns out to be true, that actually, well, if what you say that there isn't enough clarity around whether US surveillance laws pertain to data that's held in Europe anyway, then does this just, that would just make this argument sort of null and void in any case. But what additional issues does that throw up? You know, it feels to me like this is a combination, never mind the legalities of it and the unsatisfactory kind of conclusion, which leaves many data owners not knowing what they should do next. And like you say, in a virtually impossible position, it sort of does two things, which is throw a spotlight on US surveillance laws and the extent to which they can reach, and then throw a spotlight on where data owners are sharing their information to and to what extent they feel confident about how that data and information is protected. Maybe Lindsay, I'll give you an opportunity to dive in and then Townsend hear a bit more from you on that.
Yeah, I mean, all I have to add to this are questions, unfortunately, Rachel and Townsend. I mean, there's a lot that's quite unknown, really. As you've just alluded to, Townsend, like there's so much that, so many questions that we still don't have answers to, and there's a lot of interpretation at the moment. There's one thing that I saw that I'm interested in your perspective on is can these data transfers between the EU and the US still happen under GDPR Article 49 derogations? What I'm hearing a lot about people saying that you can make those transfers, but not in the same frequency with which you can currently make them under the Privacy Shield. So that's something I'm curious about. The other thing is that the UK aspect of all this, because we are kind of in between a rock and a hard place at the moment when it comes to Brexit, and our relationship with the EU is we're trying to create some kind of Privacy Shield-esque protocol with the EU to have safe transferring of data between us and the EU. We're also trying to do something similar with the US, so sort of Privacy Shield type thing would remain in place. As I understand it, we are modelling our EU data transferring protocol largely on Privacy Shield. If that's now been deemed unlawful, then we obviously can't do that anymore. And will the EU be happy transferring data to the UK if they think the UK have a similar agreement in place with the US, and that data can just go from us to the US and we can be used as almost like a literal
passporting?
Yeah, exactly. So that I'm very curious about as well. And then the other thing is, if I were a brand or an agency or a publisher, and I was using third-party vendors that, for example, that were one of these 5,000-6,000 companies that are registered under Privacy Shield, am I under now any obligation? Do I have to be looking at what data I hold, what data these companies hold? And is it up to me, or is it up to the likes of, say, Google, for example, if I'm using analytics, if I'm using things like AdWords, who is now responsible for making sure that this data is safe in being transferred? And does the data even need to be transferred? Can I, as an individual company, opt out of my data being transferred to the US if I don't think it needs to be and it just needs to remain local? So, yeah. Townsend's just doing a timeout in her hand. She's like, stop, please. Help me.
I was just about to say, it feels like this could be another, US House Select Committee interview here.
Grilling.
What happens under this set of circumstances? Who's responsible for this? Townsend, I don't know if you want to come back on any of that or some of that.
Maybe I just take the last bit first. So that's a sort of the controller. So the scenario that's I think that the most common scenario for use of the Privacy Shield has been a scenario where the controller is sitting in Europe and a processor, it's a processor. So in principle, the controller must always know, you know, where all their data is. The controller is the one that determines the purposes of processing, the means of the processing. And the processor just acts completely within scope of instructions provided by the controller. So controllers, you know, already know where all their data is, why it's being processed by whom, and everything. With respect to Brexit, there's a little piece of homework I should have done before we spoke. An interesting, if you try to look at why the government surveillance in the US is an issue and whether there's like some double standard being applied, does the US have particularly intrusive government surveillance rules? Does the UK have intrusive government surveillance rules that might put the UK in some kind of similar position? I guess that was sort of potential interpretation of your question. The difference, I mean, and arguably, you know, European countries as well, you know, have a lot of scope for government surveillance of citizens for. And there are these big carve outs in the treaty, you know, the European Union treaty. But European EU member states are signatories of the European Convention of Human Rights. So all exercise of government surveillance powers would need to be in compliance with the European Convention on Human Rights, and the convention would provide a basis for citizens to challenge surveillance practices that they felt were improperly invaded their privacy. I actually don't know if the UK has signed the European Convention of Human Rights. I should have looked that up. Obviously, the United and there are these, you know, the issues are arising in the ruling. There's kind of these two ways that, as I said, you know, privacy shield falls down. It's partly the, you know, latitude that the U.S. Intelligence agencies have, and it's partly the absence of adequate recourse or means of holding the U.S. government accountable that EU citizens would have. EU citizens can't claim, don't have an entitlement to have the U.S. Constitution, articles of the U.S. Constitution enforced, you know, on their behalf. So it's important to see whether in the UK, both of those things would hold true. If the UK government does have intrusive potential powers of surveillance, is it, notwithstanding that, a signatory of European Convention of Human Rights or some other, you know, comparable instrument that within which those powers would be exercised? And then, you know, what would be the opportunity for recourse by an EU national who felt that the UK government had abused its powers. And it's not a slam dunk that Brexit means the UK will be in the same position and an adequacy decision couldn't be adopted.
So yeah, just a quick search suggests that they will still be signatories to the convention on to the European Convention on Human Rights, but I guess that sort of stuff can change, right? So what has often been said in UK politics is that much of the much of the protective elements of European law that the UK was signatories to would be somehow, you know, sort of mimicked or replicated in UK law. In fact, much of it already is. So they also state that although the Britain will continue to be a signatory of the European Convention on Human Rights, that's also almost all of those principles are enshrined in the UK Human Rights Act, which was established like back in the late 90s. So, you know, actually there's plenty of scope for updating. There's plenty of scope for things changing. So I guess who knows? I mean, there's just a whole, you know, sort of quite long list of potential implications. I suppose my question would be, in the interest of us not disappearing into a 30-minute conversation on this one particular topic because it's
so far-reaching.
I
think we already have done.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say is to sort of move our thinking on a little bit, what's going to happen next? What's the immediate next sort of stage of all of this? Because as you interestingly pointed out, Townsend, this is effective as of now, right? So things have changed already. What do you know is going to happen next? What do you think might happen next? Are we going to see some appeals? Are we going to see people scrabbling around trying to get more clarification? What are the likely next moves here?
So I'm not completely, you know, I haven't been following the case so closely. My understanding is that the next thing that will happen, this was just a referential ruling to the court. So this is the Irish High Court going to the European Court and asking for clarification. And interestingly, of course, the European courts ended up going, taking a little bit more license and saying more about Privacy Shield than the High Court would necessarily have required, than the questions from the High Court would necessarily have required. So the High Court will rule on what was originally a dispute between Max Schrems and the Irish Data Protection Commissioner. And then the Irish Data Protection Commissioner will need to take account of the High Court's ruling. And I think the expectation is that the High Court's ruling will not happen probably, you know, before the end of this year, beginning of next year. In the interim, the fact is that Privacy Shield's been annulled. So that's just a, you know, straight line in the ruling. I guess companies will just, like, you know, scramble and look through their, look at which processors they're working with on the basis of the Privacy Shield, see how quickly they can get in place standard contractual clauses that have already been approved in principle, you know, by the commission or local DPA. Those clauses are generic and they're not connected to any geography. They're just, you know, data protection clauses that are considered to, you know, render solid protections of citizens' fundamental rights. So they'll check those clauses, see what else might usefully be added to the clauses. As we said before, I don't think they're going to be able to add anything that will limit the reach of the U.S. intelligence agencies. So some companies can try to make the case that they are unlikely to be the object of kind of sweeping, you know, vacuum type information requests. That may be harder for the bigger companies, and I think Max Schrems will probably read the news this morning. I imagine Max Schrems is going to put it to the Irish Data Protection Commissioner that as is clear in the ruling, the DPAs are actually obliged to take action. If there is a request for injunctive relief, so for a transfer to be suspended, those would be the things. It's big question marks. Maybe, you know, maybe a certain amount of maybe this will feed more and more data location in Europe.
Interesting. I suppose from a practical point of view, as you alluded to earlier as well, Townsend, you didn't say this, I'm absolutely paraphrasing, I want to make this clear, but that if you're a smaller company, you might just kind of bury your head in the sand, cross your fingers and hope it doesn't impact you, right? Lindsay, any final words on this? What do you think the sort of, you know, day-to-day impact is going to be for some people in the ad tech and martech industry?
I think in the ad tech and martech industry, there'll be a little bit of confusion to start with. We won't really know what they should or should not be doing. And then things will kind of calm down. They'll probably realise that if they haven't already been using these SCC, standard contractual clauses, they'll start using them. But that means having to sign sort of thousands of them potentially, rather than just having the buffer of Privacy Shield. And I think they'll just have to, much like with everything else when it comes, when regulation comes through with any kind of data processing, they will just have to kind of wait and see and make each move as each new thing is announced. But there'll be lots of ruckus and furore in the meantime, I imagine, and lots of moaning.
Yeah, That sounds about right. Okay, I'm going to move us on to story two. This is a conversation about eBay launching a new audience targeting product, which they're doing by using their own shopper data and user profiles. Product is called eBay Advanced Audience Technology. It's very clearly, a response to, well, perhaps not a response, but it's very clearly nicely timed to be handling an environment where third-party cookie tracking is no longer viable, no longer easy thing to do. And it's very much addressing the concept of needing to sort of build and apply first-party data for the purposes of targeting and segmentation. They claim the product isn't only designed to assist marketers in targeting ads to the audiences and customers that they're looking for, but also it's going to be something that's useful for contextual targeting and therefore, you know, searching for new audiences and wider and broader audiences. And it's being sort of promoted as a product that's offering much more granularity beyond what you might have been looking to a data management platform before in the past. It feels like this is not an altogether unexpected or unusual move. You know, we are starting to see many companies and organizations that have got lots of customer data and first party data finding ways to make that available to, to advertisers and in other contexts to publishers. So, you know, this seems like a pretty compelling move from eBay. Interested in your thoughts on the extent to which it will be a compelling offering for marketers. You know, it's got a clear application in terms of marketers looking to target specific audiences within the eBay marketplace, but will they be also, I suppose, enticed by the concept of discovering new audiences, contextual targeting? Will it be an opportunity for marketers and brands to sort of scale their potential, audience of buyers in a sort of new and more effective way? Lindsay, I'm going to start with you first on this one.
Yeah, I think this is interesting because, as you said, Rachel, we're seeing lots of publishers go down this route now, and they're looking back in their own houses and going, we've got a lot of first party data here we could make use of. And it does just go to show how easy third party data has been for so many different people. But just because you can use it doesn't mean you should use it. And actually, if you take the time and the resource to look into what you actually have access to yourselves, you could do a lot more with it. And I think this is what a lot of people are realizing. Obviously, there's many terrible bad things for many different people about the death of the third party cookie. But one thing it does make you do is actually go and look and see, well, actually, how can I do this better and differently? And maybe it turns out that my use of third party data previously actually wasn't very accurate. It wasn't the best use of our resources. And we weren't getting the results that we wanted to get. Actually, we have this wealth of first party data that we could do much better with. The thing about eBay is obviously as a marketplace, they've got the data of somebody who is both a buyer, probably a buyer and a seller. So you can get a really good rich profile of the kind of things they're buying versus the kinds of they're selling. And there are some people that I know people that literally use eBay for everything. And they'll be able to get really rich profile data from these people to know exactly the kinds of clothes they wear, exactly the kind of things they have in their house, like the knickknacks they buy and that kind of stuff, the furniture they're buying and selling. So it'll be really interesting to be able to use that data effectively. But there are others who use eBay so infrequently that I wonder how, that could then render this first party data, and this is the limitations of first party data, is all you have access to is stuff on your own platform. And if you can't enrich it or enhance it with third party data or less frequently, you run the risk of having a very kind of single-minded view of your user base and what they've done on your platform, which is why the likes of contextual kind of comes into the mix to be able to give people a more rounded view of what people are up to. And I think that will probably be the limitations of eBay. Like if I think about my profile on eBay, they wouldn't really know anything about me based on what I've done on it, and any searches I make, we don't necessarily redefine me and who I am or what I'm looking at. So, but then you could argue neither does third party data either, because it's more probabilistic anyway. So I think that it'd be interesting for them. And I think, we talked about South China Morning Post in Hong Kong doing something similar with their first party data. We talked about JP Politiken Hus in Denmark doing something similar with their first party data. The difference here is that these guys are, a retailer, a marketplace versus a news publisher. And I think that will mean that they can do some interesting stuff, but I question kind of the how much of this is that you imagine most of their data is logged in data rather than passerby traffic because of the nature of what eBay is and does. So I think it's an interesting one.
Yeah. And that's exactly it, is that, like you say, we've seen other publishers doing something very similar to try to offer targeting and segments to brands and advertisers, but they don't necessarily have the breadth of marketplace that eBay's got. So you can understand how this could be compelling. But like you, Lindsay, I wonder what the reach is really like. I forget about eBay these days. I shouldn't admit that because we talk about it all the time on the Mad Tech podcast, but I just don't think to search for stuff on eBay. It's really an afterthought for me. So I'm really interested in the profile of users that do.
Well, likewise, I don't really use it, but I know people that use it religiously. So if I look at my own profile, I think, well, eBay must be dying surely, because I don't use it. But if I look at some of these people and I go, okay, no, it's not. No, it's alive and well.
Yeah. Townsend, tell us about your eBay habits.
I am on eBay not infrequently for very specific and antique searches. So I'm interested in 18th century Delft tiles and a particular kind of porcelain from the Low Countries and oriental rugs. And so I'm not sure what you'd pitch me on the basis of that other than exactly those items. And so that's funny. Yeah, I mean I would agree with everything Lindsay said. I think that maybe one add-on Uber point is the very interesting questions of winners and losers in the post third party cookie landscape. You know, we'll get to a post third party cookie landscape. Will we get to a post identifier landscape? I don't know. You know, that seems sort of yet to be figured out. But it is interesting to see how this does seem to create a new, put a little more wind in the sails, create a new opportunity for what's maybe a kind of second tier of strong first parties, publishers and marketplaces that have a new opportunity to compete with the biggest platforms, and we'll have the scale of first party data to make that interesting. And also, compete and make contextual advertising interesting. I think I think we should all have one eye on what the impact of this is going to be on small generalist news publishers, for whom who won't have the scale, won't have the money to invest in, feature lifestyle and travel and other sections that would make contextual advertising attractive, and the degree to which our democracies still depend on small generalist local news doing investigative reporting. What the impact will be on that, and will we? Yeah, what are the there's like a good news story in terms of potentially, more competition and then maybe a mixed story about the degree to which ad spend and influence will accrue to a small number of well positioned media, sort of in the way things were in the old days. And I don't know, it's a fascinating topic.
I mean, it sort of points just to that, to the conversation that's been going on in the industry for quite a while, which is the importance of diversification for publishers, right, in terms of their monetization models. Depends very much on what type of publisher they got, what publisher they are, what type of titles or assets they have. And like you say, this is an example of eBay that's not a news publisher but can utilize first-party data and also have a massive marketplace. And I'm assuming that they can be offering this product across Gumtree and any other eBay-owned sites, right? So if you like, it's creating their own walled garden outside of other walled gardens. But then, as you say, the challenge still remains for those smaller news publishers and even for news publishers in general, right, who still haven't cracked, very much experimenting with various monetization models but haven't necessarily cracked the code, as it were. And partly that's to do with consumer behaviour as well. We're all fickle in the ways in which we consume this content and information. So, straight up subs wall, it doesn't work for everybody. Straight up ad funded doesn't necessarily work for everybody. There needs to be a bit of a mixture. I don't know, Lindsay, if you've got something to add to that.
No, not really. I think I agree with you. I think there can't be a one size solution fits all in this new world that we're going to be living in. Everyone has to come up with different ways of monetizing different aspects of their audience, different aspects of the traffic. And the likes of eBay, where they have a lot of first party data and probably not so much pass-by traffic, it stands to reason that it probably will be a very, very predominantly first party approach. But it doesn't mean that there isn't a need to look at other options like contextual semantic targeting and looking at other ways of maybe looking at second party data and looking at partnerships with other people they're working with. And then the news publishers will have to appreciate and accept that they will not be able to get all of their users to log in. Like, it's not going to be possible. So we have to, while that is important and while first party data is going to be very, very prevalent for them, and they'll be able to monetize that data potentially better than they will do their pass-by traffic, they have to also try and find a solution pass-by traffic that isn't trying to convert all of them into being logged on users, because it's just not going to work realistically for most news publishers.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you mentioned that. This is a helpful segue to story number three, which is a neat segue, a highly overused word by me, but I haven't said it in the Mad Tech podcast for at least a few weeks. So there we go. It's an opportunity to get it back in there. This is an interesting story coming from Australia. What's being touted as a sort of an advertiser-funded paywall for publisher properties. Actually, I suppose you could say it's, well, I thought anyway when reading it, it's a bit of a take on sort of reward or incentivized advertising. The idea that the reader scrolls through an article, gets a pop-up saying to consume more of this, you need to interact somehow with advertising, either accept viewing advertising. It could be a video, it could be a static ad, etc. It could have a call to action, it might not. But the idea is that it's following on from, I suppose, the concept as well of micropayments. The idea is that the advertiser pays in this instance. So if the user accepts interacting with the ad, then the advertiser pays the publisher, the idea being that it's an advertiser-funded paywall as it is described. So I guess this, it's a follow-on from what we were just talking about, the importance of publishers having to diversify their monetization, opportunities. I think that I'd be really interested to see how this unfolds. Australia is a good marketplace to be testing something like this, because it's got we joke about it sometimes, it's relatively small population-wise. It's on the other side of the world. Most people don't notice what's going on there. So if it's a massive disaster, no one will know. But of course, we don't really live in that world these days. Everyone knows what's happening in Australia at the moment with respect to COVID. So I guess there's no secrets anywhere. But I'm just interested to know whether you guys think this is a proposition that is perhaps nicely fitted to some of those smaller news publishers that we were talking about, or will it be something that will just be too difficult to scale because it's very much obviously based on levels of interactivity with individual readers? I don't know. I've got mixed views on this. For a long time, it's not the same thing at all. But for a long time, I think probably many people were skeptical of the Guardian's sort of donation subs model. And actually, over the years, it's worked. So could this be something similar that gains traction over time as people's consumption behaviour sort of moderates, changes a little bit? People get used to the concept of that value exchange and being asked to do something in exchange for consuming the content. Townsend?
So it's funny you mentioned The Guardian, because I've supported The Guardian for a long time, and I don't know if it's still happening, but I do remember for the first few months anyway, I'd be continually presented with the option of paying, joining, even though I had, even though I was a supporter and
already,
and drove me really crazy, actually.
Yeah.
So it sounds like intrusive format. It's obviously intended to be. I wonder, it goes a little bit against the grain of some of the work that we've been involved in with this Coalition for Better Ads about trying to make advertising sort of less disruptive, but the whole point is to disrupt. It might be an opportunity, as you say, Rachel, to you can't jam too many words in, and advertisers may not be interested in this. But it's an opportunity, either explicitly or implicitly, to remind people that one way of paying for editorial content is advertising. I think it could, you could imagine that, depending on how it played out and how it was implemented, it might be something that would distract publishers from cultivating their first party relationships in other, in other ways. But I don't know, as in the spirit of the improvisation and need to kind of look under every rock and innovate, that you mentioned a few minutes ago, Rachel, why not give it a shot? And there probably will be quite a lot of attention around the globe to see how it goes.
Lindsay?
So I saw something similar to this. I mean, this concept isn't especially new. I don't know about how the advertiser pays or how the publisher was, how the publisher was able to monetize it. But I saw a similar ad to this maybe 5-6 years ago. And it was an ad on a UK news publisher, and you got through sort of halfway through the article and then ad came up. And to read the rest of the article, you had to answer a question that was based on the ad you just viewed. And if you got the question correct, you could view the rest of the article.
And that's interesting.
It was like an insurance ad or something. So it's like, so how many, what percentage of the UK population is not insured, has life insurance? It was like, interesting. And you're sort of going, what the hell is this? And I looked at it again, I was like, actually, it's a great idea.
Yeah,
and
I
remember
that.
It because at the time I thought, you know what, I am engaging with this ad, and you are forcing me, whether I want to or not, you are forcing me to physically read it, not just click something to get rid of the damn ad, which I thought was a really clever way of doing something. This obviously isn't quite that, because the ad gate models are, you can show an ad and then just kind of get people to view it and then just swipe across, or have like a sponsored read more button that they can just click or swipe and then the rest of the article appears. But I think that there's room to play with it. And I was kind of disappointed that when I saw that and I really liked it, kind of I never really saw it again anywhere.
Again.
And I was like, I wonder kind of what the scalability opportunities of this. I'm like, and 5-6 years ago, maybe that wasn't necessary, it wasn't needed, because back then, we were still doing, many publishers, I'm not talking about sort of premium publishers, many publishers were still living in a world where they could just kind of put as many ad units on a page as they wanted to, and they could monetize it. Viewability was obviously important and coming to the fore, but it was still kind of like, well, it doesn't matter, I just need to monetize. Now things are being taken more seriously. Maybe that, or this is a decent way of being able to monetize that passerby traffic. Although Townsend's point about, would it prevent you or distract you from cultivating your first part relationships, I think is an interesting one, because that's something that you can't do. Like we talked in the previous eBay story about the value of first part relationships, and you will arguably always get more money from them. This is supposed to be 10, 20 times higher revenue for publishers than a standard display ad would be. But I would argue that monetizing your first party data is probably still going to be even higher because of the value that an advertiser would place on that data when they're kind of entering into a relationship with you and your first party data. But I think that this is an interesting way of being able to look at the rest of that pass-by traffic that, as I obviously previously said, I believe no real publisher will be able to get all of their users to be logged in. So how do you try and monitor the rest of it? I think this is an interesting way of doing it, but I do worry about, because of the fact that I know this exists already and has been done, and actually arguably, in my opinion, done in a more interesting way than this is, with the kind of asking a question, that clearly it wasn't able to be, there could be many reasons why it didn't work out, but it wasn't able to be scaled for whatever reason. And maybe now we're in a time where that kind of thing could be scaled, but I worry that it won't be, because there are too many far bigger companies out there that have got things that work well for them that would mean that a publisher would still get drawn to those existing relationships and not try out these new ways of monetizing that data. But I think it's interesting. And as you say, Rachel, it's very similar to rewarded video in gaming, for example, which is hugely popular. And there are many naysayers to it that say you are forcing an ad down somebody's throat, and you shouldn't have to force somebody to engage with an ad, but actually you have a captive audience. Rewarded video is proven to work really, really well. You could argue we're already doing that with likes of audio and TV and video anyway by forcing people to watch an ad. So why should this be any different? And at least it might force me to take in information within an ad that I would otherwise ignored, and maybe it would be interesting to me. So maybe that is a good thing. I don't know.
I think an interesting aspect of that is sort of what kind of content would it lend itself to, and where would you put the ad in the content? And this gets back to the behavior point we were talking about earlier. I noticed with myself, and I'm a huge reader, you know, and like my whole, you know, education and career up to now, I'm a very careful reader. And but I've found in the last few years that I often now, my attention span's gotten shorter, even at you know, my age. And so I often will just drop an article 2/3 of the way through because I like gotten the thrust of it, you know. So it probably the success of that might depend on where you put it in the and what kind of content.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point actually, because the likes of the tabloids are well aware of this, and the younger generation particularly consume everything in bite size. That's why TikTok is, you know, everything is like 10 seconds, 6 seconds, 15 seconds. So Daily Mail is a great example of this, that they put the bulk of the article in like 6 bullet points at the very top. The headline is about 300 characters long, yeah. And then they've got the kind of the synopsis just below it. And because they know that nobody reads the whole article. So I'd be fascinated to know of kind of Mail Online traffic, how many read those top 6 bullet points and how many actually then go on to the rest of the article. Because then you'd argue this kind of solution would not be appropriate for most people and most younger generations that don't consume news in that way anymore.
No. Yeah. And I've been thinking actually, you know, there's a real skill in writing those headlines and those bullet points, not just for the attention of it, but to even just make it make sense, right? You know, you're so right. Daily Mail, you know, headlines and opening bullet points are not, you know, that's not taught in school. No one really knows how to do that. You got to learn that on the job. And it's really hard. So I sort of imagine there's all of these kind of Oxbridge graduates working for the Daily Mail in the editorial department, sitting around trying to work out how to make sense of something in, yeah, a massive headline and 5 bullet points. And of course, then they've got all the, you know, all the enticing photographs, which are the real clickbait, the things that people really click through to get to the article for. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that this is a, this also strikes me as something that obviously would need to be sort of carefully inserted at the right time, the right point, and depending on the publication. So it seems like another in what is now a growing list of potential monetization strategies that need to be revisited constantly for publishers, I think, just because consumer behaviour is changing so much as well. So what we would be prepared to tolerate today, we wouldn't have done as much as 12 months ago, I'm guessing. And I think that's just going to continue to change at a pace as well. In the interest of time, I'm moving us on to second part of the podcast. Townsend, please tell us what has been going on at IAB Europe of late and what particularly you guys have been focusing on.
So we are, as I said at the start of our call, we've got two legs to our business, and the policy and regulatory work and the business side committees, and which overlap to a greater degree now than they ever did historically. So the policy and regulatory work has been mostly focused on privacy and data protection, which, you know, sort of languished in obscurity until GDPR was adopted and has now become much more visible and, you know, boardroom and strategic area. So on the Brussels side, we are looking to the rollout of TCF version 2.0. So our switchover date is 15th of August. And that is the moment as from which the V1.1 global vendor list and technical support for V1.1 will no longer be available. So and V2 really, really, really is fully implemented. People will be able to use their V1.1 signals until the end of September. So there's like a little transition period. Everybody doesn't have to get new consent, you know, like immediately, all the strings don't become invalid, but so there'll be a little bit of a transition period. But that's a big milestone for us. It's a year after TCF V1 V2 actually was finalized and issued, and so that's been an important development on the legal compliance side. There is still a big policy agenda in Brussels. And there are some really, really interesting discussions on intermediary liability and potential legal framework for artificial intelligence that are, you know, going to be really important for the digital advertising industry. We're focused really closely on what's happening in the W3C and the IABUS Project REARC reflection on the post third-party cookie landscape and environment, and what the opportunities and challenges are there. On the business side, we are working on, we have actually just issued a set of brand safety and brand suitability definitions and best practices for Europe. So that's on our website right now. And we have released in June, so a few weeks ago, Buyer's Guide to CTV, including European level definitions and best practices. And we have upcoming in October, a Buyer's Guide to Digital Audio that's in the process of being being pulled together right now, being worked on right now by the colleagues that are our business side colleagues. So those are, that's kind of our priority preoccupations for the moment.
So not much on then. You're all having a really easy time sitting around with your feet up on the desk. Yeah. Right. to what extent has the sort of crazy world that we've been living in 2020 impacted any or some of that activity? You know, I know, you know, IAB Europe, like other IAB chapters as well, you know, relies on, interacting through your committees, but also through various events and so forth. Obviously, as much as possible, it's just moved into a virtual capacity. But have you gauged anything from the European community that's led you to feel as though some things might have sped up or some things might have decelerated as a result of the chaos that's unfolded around us this year?
So I think there has been, at the EU institutional level, there has been obviously quite a lot of focus on COVID. We've watched some files lapse a little bit, or lose a little bit of pace. E-privacy and is ticking over, but there was definitely a period during the lockdown where everything shifted to what Europe could be doing to help the member states on COVID. Our own lives. So we're a team of about, we're probably like 15 now, 13, 14, have moved, transitioned very nicely to working from home. We did our big annual event virtually, and actually had, 1500 people sign up or something. And, quite a lot of, reasonable amount of, traction for a smaller number of tightly focused virtual events. We fortunately don't depend particularly financially on face-to-face events. And I think it's been hard for some of my national organizations who do. We've been a little bit less exposed to that. Like everyone, we've probably, changed our own, flipped our own substantive focus a little bit. So our chief economist, Daniel Knapp, has been doing work on trying to project the impact of COVID on digital ad spend over, the rest of this year and 2021, and done work on that obviously otherwise we wouldn't have done. Mm-hmm.
Hugely useful though, seeing a lot of Daniel's updates. Maybe it seems like a sort of an obvious area of support, but I can't, I wouldn't want to underestimate how complex it is. So I think that's been enormously helpful for the industry, because not least of all, because it's virtually impossible to predict where things are going financially.
Exactly.
When we're not just at the behest of COVID, but most global economies were heading for somewhat of a recession anyway. So, it's very difficult to kind of work out exactly what's happening and what's as a result of the pandemic and what's as a result of some natural forms of economic slowdown. So that seems to be really helpful. I'd wondered, that was an interesting synopsis you gave, because I think Kieran and I, Lindsay, you might have been party to this conversation a little while ago, where just sort of musing over whether we were talking specifically actually about people, about sort of, the industry in the US and whether they're as consumed with, you know, the disappearance of third-party cookies and developing an identity solution as we are in Europe. You know, that's a real focus for the European industry, and there's a lot of European ad tech companies that are looking to solve for identity. And it just feels as though there's a bit of a the less concerns about it in the US. And that, maybe that's not true, you know, but it's just an impression that we've had from the idea that firstly they're in their own sort of chaotic maelstrom with respect to the pandemic, but secondly, I don't know if it's that it's a much bigger marketplace, a very homogenous, generic marketplace where maybe some ad tech vendors especially feel like they can just carry on the way that they are for some time until things really start to get difficult and they're really pressed, or whether it's just that we've got a little bit more tech innovation happening in the European landscape. Don't know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So I'm not sure I would have made the same observation about the an absence of sense of urgency. U.S. markets, you know, it's big place, big community, and everything. We are, as IAB Europe, we're trying to support the work that IAB Tech Lab is running, this, you know, Project ReArc Reflection. Yep. Also trying to feed into the W3C. Part of the complexity. A feature of the reflection is the complexity of just the instances, the institutional aspect of it. You know, W3C is different from IAB Tech Lab. We have some conversations that are mostly focused on addressability in the Tech Lab, mostly focused on an identifier, some kind of identifier type approach in ReArc, and then which is a little bit distinct from and complementary to W3C's current focus on, you know, a pure no identifier landscape. It's interesting to see how some of the premises with respect to policy and privacy of the W3C conversation, some of those premises are at variance with where Europe is. Europe is sort of the leading, vanguard jurisdiction in thinking about privacy and data protection. We have the most sophisticated, the most comprehensive, the most progressive regulatory framework for privacy in the world. And yet these conversations taking place in Washington in a market that does not have anything like the prescriptive and exigent rules that we have here, that conversation is kind of based on a very extreme notion of what constitutes privacy, what is required to satisfy the needs of consumer privacy. So it's weird. You know, it's a little bit strange. It's hard to know how to. It's hard in some ways to know how to. Integrate into that conversation and what the right timing is. So I think there is scope inside the W3C for insertion and integration of a global vision for privacy that draws on some important elements of the framework we have here without being, you know, well, we need GDPR for Europe, GDPR for the world, because, you know, nobody wants that. But it feels as if there is an opportunity to query and challenge some of the assumptions of the W3C discussions, but it's hard to know how to take the cactus. And so that's something that we're spending some time thinking about right now. And we've got probably, I don't know, 250 organizations in our post third-party cookie task force, trying to, just as you suggest, Rachel, you know, trying to even out or ensure good European input into those US-based reflections. I think there is good. There are good European contributions, but it's a really complex topic and all kinds of different agendas.
Yeah. That's fascinating. That's actually a really useful sort of update from your perspective and from your experience of where those conversations are at across yourselves, Tech Lab with Project REARC, W3C, all just such an interesting time in our industry. So many critical things that yourselves and those other organisations are working on. So it's just going to be, fascinating to see where we end up. I think we've run out of time. Thank you very much, Townsend. It was a real pleasure. It's lovely to have you involved in the podcast and to hear much more about what IAB Europe are up to. Lindsay, it's always a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be on the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thanks for listening, everybody. And that was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.